on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. You're with Lindy Burns.
Beautiful, don't you think?
What?
The sunrise.
Terrific.
Oh, it all went horribly wrong from there. If you've seen Gravity, you'll know exactly what's going on and where we've moved in the last couple of minutes. Yes, to the world of films and indeed the best films for this year. We'd love to hear your suggestions on 0437 774 774. But Josh Nelson is in, as he's been on such a regular basis, although not recently. We'll talk about why in a moment. Throughout the year on Drive with Raf Epstein. Hello, Josh.
Good afternoon, Lindy.
That was Gravity.
That was.
Was that your favourite?
No, look, I'm going to buck the trend a little bit with my list. And I don't like calling them, this is a pedantic aspect of me, a best list.
Stop it.
Unless you've seen all of them. Look, I'm going to call them my personal favourites. Very different reasons. Gravity, it made it. Although, interestingly, a week ago, it had slipped off. So I went and revisited on Wednesday afternoon and it shot back into the list again.
Let's go back there. You can't just make that sweeping statement. So it had slipped off because something else had popped into the list?
Well, I think at the time I saw it, I was blown away by it, and it was such an immersive film, such a kind of, particularly in terms of the visual landscape, the technology involved in putting this film together, which led to questions like, you know, Alfonso Cuarón, how did you go filming in space? That famous question that he was asked overseas. Genius. But for some reason, I think it had sort of, the initial experience had sort of tapered off a bit. So I wanted to go and re-experience it in 3D, and I did. And I realized, actually, there was more I realized on a second viewing than I appreciated on more than just the technical level. I had some issues with the script on a first viewing. They didn't sort of bother me so much on the second time around. So, yeah, this is a great film. And it is a cinema film. It's nice to have a cinema film. That's,
you know. Did you see them both times in 3D or did you do a 2D episode?
I did both in 3D. I didn't actually get along to IMAX, so I haven't had potentially the full Gravity experience where people were leaving because they got dizzy spells, apparently.
I've only seen the 2D.
Right.
Which was fine. You and I have talked before about how I'm hopeless with movies. I love the idea. It's like camping. I love the idea of movies. I love the idea of camping. It's just, you know, doing it that I find a little difficult, getting myself organised enough to be able to go and see something. But I have seen Gravity, and I thought it was a marvellous thing. But not. I'm much more immersed in films when the story grabs me emotionally. I didn't have that experience with Gravity. I just found myself just every now and then just going, oh, golf clap, well done. Oh, that was impressive. Oh, how do they do that? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's why I think the experience tapered off a bit because I wasn't won over by the Sandra Bullock transcendental monologues that we sort of get at every space station that she goes to before that gets destroyed and she has to go to the next one. That got a little bit too much for me. It was a little bit too of the sort of the American religiosity that sort of wore me down a little. But just from a purely sort of visceral experience, yeah, I loved it.
Religiosity.
I know, I'm making words up. Friday, I can do that.
That's fantastic. No, let's use it. Let's use it over and over again. Please, says Doug, don't give away any of the plot points for Gravity. I'm waiting for it to come out on 3D Blu-ray.
Right.
So, sorry, Doug.
I hope you've got a big TV at home.
I hope it is. And Steve going, I saw it. I thought it was boring. See, people have all sorts of different reactions to things. I don't think it was boring. Although, as you say, the exploration, what is it, not expiration?
Exposition. Yep.
That goes on for with Sandra Bullock. Yeah, it turns a little tedious. Jane, however, says this. Blue Jasmine, Kate Blanchett is absolutely amazing.
I'm dead broke, really. I mean, the government took everything.
All I can say is you look great.
Oh, now who's lying?
Is there anything you want that you don't have?
Sweetheart, it's beautiful.
When your sister had all that money, she wanted nothing to do with you. Now that she's broke, all of a sudden she's moving in.
She's not just broke. She's all screwed up.
Cool off, you know. You hear me?
Excuse me. Are you talking to me?
Ginger told me all about you. One minute you're on top of the world, the next guy turns out to be a crook. Well, how long are you planning on staying with Ginger?
No one wants to get out of here as fast as I do.
She's a genius. Blue Jasmine, where did that? It's in your list. Is it up high or?
It made the short list. It made the larger short list. I love this film.
The long short list.
I love this film primarily for Kate Blanchett's performance. I have been sort of lukewarm on her for a number of years, but this was the best of Kate. I think this really showed how great she is at tragic and comic, and that's where I think she works beautifully with Woody Allen, because he's one of those few directors, I think, even though he's had a lot of duds in recent years, that can balance those two aspects. And the film really is a sort of an exercise in balancing tragedy and comedy. And I thought his sort of reimagining of A Streetcar Named Desire was really clever, particularly in terms of the Stella sister, giving her more of a role, splitting the Stanley Kowalski character into an old man and a young man, so playing on sort of the sister's repetitious behaviour and that mirroring the Kate Blanchett character's one. Yeah, look, this was a smart film, and it was so nice to see Woody Allen back in form.
Yes, although I've been such a fan of his for such a long period of time and there's so many films, I'm just prepared to wear something that's terrible.
Well, he's so prolific, so you've got to take that.
You just move on. Yep. Well, don't worry, because there'll be another one out in 6 months' time. The fascinating thing about Blue Jasmine 2 that I've heard, because I have to admit that I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard that, and about Captain Phillips, which is another that we'll talk about, is that the performances by the two main actors in Cate Blanchett for Blue Jasmine and Tom Hanks for Captain Phillips, they shine at their best, and the brilliance of their abilities as performers shines the most in the final scenes of both films. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You can always pick, and I don't think that this is the filmmaker's intention, but that's the grab that'll be at the Oscars. That's the bit they'll show just before they announce the names, the nominations are being read out. Tom Hanks, again, he's won a lot of flack, and I guess being a prolific actor, he does a lot of films where he seems to be on cruise control, and I think he has that idea of he's just Oscar baiting, you know, for much of his career. This, I think, is a different side we haven't seen for quite some time. And yeah, the punch that he delivers at the second last or penultimate scene in this film is really, really remarkable.
This is Mask, Alabama.
We are an unarmed freighter. We have two skiffs approaching with armed intruders.
Potential piracy situation.
Copy, Alabama. You should alert your crew and get your fire hoses ready.
Is that it?
Chances are it's just fishermen.
They're not here to fish.
Shot fired! Take the hoses!
This is not a drill. This is a real world situation.
Yeah, it's not going well from there, is it? Captain Phillips, starring Tom Hanks. You liked it, yeah?
I did like it. It, again, was on my broader shortlist. I didn't sort of make the final cull down to the top 10. Why we have to pick 10, I'm not sure, but that seems to be the standard practice these days.
That's what Oscars do now.
Yeah, well, it is actually. Yeah. The thing I appreciated about Captain Phillips, and it's a film I almost didn't see because I suspected it was going to be a fairly racist depiction of the Somali pirates, like bad coloured people attacking good white people. And I think the film wasn't that at all, and that's what the surprise factor was. It was very sympathetic. It tried to kind of give a balanced portrayal. It tried to get us to understand that these Somali pirates, there's a reason why they're pirating, and they don't come from the best conditions. So it dealt with the economics of the situation and mirrored in a really nice way, I think, the lead Somali pirate and the Hanks character. So there's a really nice kind of relationship dynamic that the film develops out of those two. And it's a really tense film as well, and it maintains that tension throughout over 2 hours, which I think is a trait that a lot of filmmakers struggle with at the moment.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Does Hanks get the Oscar?
Ooh, I think it's going to be a really tough race. It depends how sentimental. It's so political, the Oscars. Who knows? I suspect that 12 Years a Slave, which comes out in January here, will also go close. His performance in that is pretty amazing.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, you're with Lindy Burns.
Josh Nilsson is here, and we are talking about favourite films of 2013, or at least the ones that have grabbed people's attention. Let's move to one that I must admit, Josh, that I didn't expect to be on a list of yours, although I may just be being a bit rude. Spring Breakers. Why?
Spring Breakers, I think the reason this made the distance or lasted the distance of the year on my favourite films is because I haven't been able to get it out of my system. It's like some sort of Thai parasite. It sort of dug its head in, and it just won't let up.
Can I make it even a bit worse for you right now?
Come on in, sunshine. Shine, little bit. Where's the money?
Money.
What?
You know what?
All I know is I'm not going to sit here another day.
Spring break.
How are we going to get enough money?
I don't know. We're the only ones still here. Spring break. I'm tired of seeing the same thing.
Spring break.
It's your chance to see something different.
Spring break.
Just get the cash. Pretend like it's a video game. We can do this.
Spring break.
It just sounds terrible. I mean...
Well, they're trying to describe it. It's basically the actors, the actresses in it come from the sort of the Mickey Mouse Club band of kind of acting school.
Acting?
And they play these Gen Y girls, first year college girls who decide to pull off a robbery and head down to, I think it's Florida, to live it up spring break style. And it sort of goes horribly wrong when they meet a drug dealer played by James Franco in one of his 300 performances this year, it seems like. There's something very clever that the filmmaker Harmony Korine is doing here in terms of exploring this idea of violence and this sort of dark underside of American culture, but through the, you know, through mirroring to this sort of bright, kind of glitzy, plastic popular culture. I mean, there's one moment which I thought was great where Franco plays Britney Spears on a piano and starts singing along, and it kickstarts this montage where they're basically pillaging Florida, pillaging sort of neighborhoods and gangland style. It's a film that's quite strange. I'm not sure I know exactly what he's doing, but I'm still utterly intrigued by it. And visually, from just a sort of stylistic point of view, I think it's a really beautiful film as well.
Wow.
Yeah. I may be on my own there.
You might not be. We'll see if anyone texts that says, "You're an idiot, Josh," or "Josh, we love your work." So I think they're the only, you know, two fields that people could come from. Spring Breakers, what did you think? And to Stories We Tell.
Can you just go back over that one line?
I was being so real.
Well, I guess if you could start by describing Mom in as much detail as possible.
Me? Do you want me? Oh, I'm sorry.
Here is a church, and here is a steeple.
She was the most fun I could think of as a child. She was very warm. She was, you know, full of life.
I'm so glad there's a documentary in there somewhere. Well, tell me about this one.
Well, this has been a good year for documentaries, so I had to pick one, and this was probably my favourite. This is Stories We Tell by Sarah Polley, who's an actor, Canadian actor turned director. It's an exploration of her personal history, particularly her relationship with her mother, who died when she was quite young. So it's an exploration of what her family's gone through and sort of family secrets, and trying to bring them to light through interviews with her family and her father. And it raises issues of paternity as well. But the thing I really loved about this, and what elevated above just a kind of a vanity project, was that she exposes the documentary process itself to the lens of her camera. So we see her in the sound studio telling her dad to repeat certain lines or give a certain inflection on certain lines. We see her behind the camera. And I guess one of the points of the film is it's who does this story belong to? So the film is also about storytelling and who owns the right to personal history when it becomes a shared history. It's a really intelligent film. And as far as documentaries goes, it just has those extra levels, which I really appreciated.
Oh, that sounds all right.
It's a really wonderful film.
It's the one to get to. In a moment, I know that I don't know how many of those are actually in your top three or four for the year. Probably none. So we'll get that list from you in just a brief moment. But you have just come back from Toronto in Canada, where you went to see the Cronenberg Project. So what is
This is what the TIFF. So this is a project run by TIFF, run out of the Bell Lightbox, the equivalent to Acme here. David Cronenberg is a remarkable Canadian filmmaker who's been working from the 70s. People would probably know either his early work, which was lots of body horror like Rabid, The Brood, Videodrome, Shivers, that kind of thing, or more recently sort of earnest films like A Dangerous Method, the Freud film with Viggo Mortensen, or Cosmopolis, where he's moved on to sort of Robert Pattinson. And what TIFF have done and what drew me over there is they've had a full retrospective of screenings with panels, Q&As with Cronenberg present for a number of them. They have an exhibition of his work in terms of artwork, props, so that sort of the production process, but also these concurrent exhibitions showing in the Contemporary Art Gallery where they've commissioned artworks inspired by Cronenberg, and they've got Cronenberg to curate his own exhibition, a virtual exhibition. So there's about five or six different things all running at once. So Toronto's sort of been transformed into this artistic Cronenberg landscape. It's a remarkable approach to a curatorship, and I actually got the chance to speak to the curator of part of this project, Noah Cowan.
I think one of the points of an institution like TIFF Bell Lightbox is to talk about film and filmmaking in a different way. Of course, the main action takes place within our cinemas and the darkened environments, these beautiful spaces. But we need to. Film isn't as much the dominant medium in sort of global culture as it once was. And I think there's a lot of value to sort of reinscribe film within the history of the visual arts, the performing arts. So talk about it, how its relationship with painting, drawing, theater, musical performance, even dance, and whatever we can do to sort of have it really be thought of as part of that family, I think can only benefit people as they approach film, sometimes warily when it comes to art films, sometimes enthusiastically when it comes to blockbusters, but seeing the work in a different way.
I'm a true fan, but that's in a good way, I think.
Yeah, and I think it really raises the bar in terms of artistic exhibition and curatorship, because it elevates film to the status of those other art forms that he's talking about, and particularly with a director like Cronenberg, because his influence does transcend cinema. I mean, he's not like a Scorsese director who's very much self-referential within that art industry. He draws on all these other aspects, and for me, I think that's something that I don't think has been done, certainly not in this country in recent times, but even overseas. I haven't heard of a filmmaker who's been given that sort of status and that this sort of broad exhibition and curatorship across so many levels. I think it was a wonderful achievement, and it's on until January 16th. So if you are heading to North America, or like me, you want to make a spontaneous life decision and get on a plane, I highly recommend it.
That's terrific. And perhaps we should do something like that for Baz Luhrmann or something here in Australia. That would lend itself to it in a strange kind of way. And finally, Josh.
Okay. Moment of truth.
Your favourites of 2013.
Okay, look, I'll run through some of the ones we haven't mentioned yet. I should probably start with some homegrown films. Two really great Australian films that didn't get a lot of press. Satellite Boy, which had David Gopal in it, sort of about a boy and his grandfather relationship, really great. Documentary In Bob We Trust. It was my favourite Australian documentary of the year. Really great. Still showing, by the way. The other one is The Rocket. This is an Australian film set and made in Laos. Quite sadly, and it's a great film, it's been banned in Laos. So the cultural situation over there is not in a great shape, but that's a real sort of indictment, I think. So they were sort of the homegrown ones I wanted to mention.
Ken in Sandringham saying the same. Lindy and Josh, The Rocket by far is the best film of this year.
Yeah, really tremendous great filmmaking. Hopefully it'll get a DVD release soon. Look, the others I'm just going to list off, so get your pens out. Stranger by the Lake and Rust and Bone, both French films I really dug. To the Wonder, a Terrence Malick film that didn't do so well critically or through the general population, but that doesn't say much because people can be wrong en masse. Upstream Colour, another film that didn't get a great release but is a really fascinating film. And most of these films tend to be ones that are outside of the mainstream. I found most of the blockbuster fare this year pretty disappointing. The other ones that are tops, Gravity we've mentioned, The Hunt, the Mads Mikkelsen film, yes, about a man suspected of pedophilia, the mob mentality, a remarkable film, again, tense, and his performance is a standard. He should have been nominated for something. Amour, which I feel like I've been
talking
praising it for
roses
2 years because it only got a release here in February. Michael Haneke's film about the two octogenarians, love, death. It's a beautiful film and heartbreaking, but it's still worthwhile experience. And the final one, and it is Cronenberg, although it's son of Cronenberg, this is Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral. This is a sci-fi, low-budget sci-fi film dealing with body technology and I guess a sort of a semi-futuristic realm in which people buy pieces of celebrity disease and have themselves injected with it. It was a really, really fantastic debut film.
Great premise. Great premise. Thank you, Josh.
You're welcome.
A whole host of films there that people will have to catch up on over the Christmas break. Josh Nelson with his take on 2013.